Good evening, everyone. A little over a year ago, people were celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. And it also coincided with the 150th anniversary of the publication of his book on the origin of species. Now, our title is, in a sense, a parody, a counter to the title of this book, which was published by Richard Dawkins, formerly the Professor of Public Understanding at the University of Oxford. Understanding of Science, I should have said, at the University of Oxford. Now, I need to make it clear at the outset that in our title, The Darwin Delusion, we may mean no disrespect at all to a man who was, in fact, an outstanding scientist in his day. Rather, we're using it as a kind of convenient omnibus term to cover all the ideas that have stemmed from this original book on the origin of species. If you like, a sort of collective description of all the ideas that are prevalent today amongst evolutionists. Now, there is a large literature now of books that have countered Professor Dawkins' criticism of those who have a faith. It's interesting that Professor McGrath here, who is in fact a professor with quite an interesting background, which I'll relate in a moment. But the great thing that's happened is that because Professor Dawkins has been so objectionable in his criticism of those who have a belief, that quite a few scientists have now replied to him. And if you go into a typical bookshop, you'll find quite a lot of books are available now that answer the sort of comments that Professor Dawkins has made. And it can't be overemphasized that to claim, as Professor Dawkins does, that anyone who embraces a religious belief, a belief in God, is in fact mentally deluded. He believes we're insane. Now, that's rather strange, because it means then a great many famous scientists living today are also deluded. Many of them in Britain are fellows of the Royal Society, which is the highest accolade that can be conferred on a British scientist. And some of them are actually Nobel Prize winners, which, of course, is the highest accolade internationally that can be given to scientists. And what I find particularly significant is that many of the people who have opposed Dawkins are not religious. They're not Christians. They're scientists who reject the theory of evolution because they don't believe it's true. Now, we chose Professor McGrath's book because he is in a unique position. He is a scientist. He trained in the field of molecular biophysics, and he investigated biological membranes. But he also studied theology, and he's now professor of historical theology at the Oxford University. And others, for example, have retaliated. Dr. John Lennox, who is now actually a professor of mathematics in the University of Oxford, has provided a wonderful review of the scientific evidence against evolution. And if you're wondering whether the question is answered, has science buried God, the answer is absolutely not. In fact, he has now produced a revised version, so the debate continues. Now, it's very interesting that during that year, 2009, the atheists decided to advertise on buses in the major cities of Britain, and in particular London, and put up a slogan. And their slogan was, "There's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life." That's the actual detail. "There's probably no God, stop worrying and enjoy your life." And in fact, what they were really doing is saying what God had already said beforehand. "The fool has said in his heart, there's no God, let's eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die." Rather ironic, isn't it, that Scripture had anticipated the slogan of the atheists. Well, we have to answer the question, is there... there are two Bible quotations from Psalms and Isaiah that are quoted inadvertently. They don't really realize that they're making this illusion. There's probably no God, and of course that's what the Scripture says. The fool says, there's no God, so let's eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So, as I said, we need to now ask the question, Which is right? Are the creationists right and Christadelphians believe in creation, or are the evolutionists right? Well, we adhere to the opening sentence of the Bible. The very first sentence is, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And that actually is very interesting, because scientists now accept there was a beginning to the universe. When I was a younger man, it was debatable, and at that time, those who believed in a continuous, steady state of the universe seemed to be prevailing. But more recently, scientists have come to the conclusion that it once had a start, a Big Bang, as they call it. Now, one of the problems that some Christians face, and that is that they try to reconcile the idea that evolution and belief in a God, a creator, can, in fact, be reconciled. Now, I think there are two facts that we have to look at that suggest that this is not possible. Creation involves a creator, an intervention, some person, being, or whatever, that makes the universe, creates it. But evolution, in fact, is a random process based on chance. Quite interesting, isn't it, that the evolutionists can't actually tell us where the Big Bang started and where the universe, the initial part of it, where it came from. But they're completely convinced that God wasn't involved. Now, the reason why these two views are, in my opinion, irreconcilable is that they're based on two fundamentally different premises. Creation not only involves a creator, but it means that the universe and life on this planet didn't arise purely by chance. An intelligence caused it to be created, and created with a purpose. Now, on the other hand, evolution is the product of chance and random processes. There can be no purpose to the world or of life on it in terms of evolutionary thinking. It just happens. Our existence is, to quote one scientist, merely a random collocation of atoms. Nothing matters. Now, this means, of course, that those, like Professor Dawkins, who propound the concept of evolution with a zeal which would be a credit to evangelical preachers, when you think about it, that is to no purpose. It doesn't matter how much the evolutionists propound their ideas, if they're right, it doesn't matter. And that, I think, is a very important thing to grasp at the beginning. Now, personally, I have to confess that I would prefer to believe, however unimportant my contribution might be, I'd like to think there was some purpose in my existence, and I suspect you may feel the same. Now, most of the material that we're going to advance this evening will really be looking at evolution and the inadequacies that are involved in it. And then, of course, when we've dealt with evolution and dismissed it, which we will, God willing, then we shall need to spend a little time leading to a consideration of creation and its implications. Now, just to get things into perspective, we need just for a moment to think about the theory of evolution, Darwinism, if you like. Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, it's funny actually, Wallace was actually ahead of Darwin, but Darwin seemed to have always had the credit. Perhaps the problem was that Wallace was away from Britain doing research in the tropics. But they proposed a mechanism whereby new species might arise. Now, it's important to remember that a species is actually something that we define, and it's not necessarily a reality. People look at different animals and plants and they classify them, and that's a useful thing to do. But the concept of a species itself is a very difficult one, and scientists do sometimes have trouble in trying to define it. It's also important to note that evolution is a complex issue, and in the time that we have at our disposal this evening, we shall have to be somewhat selective. Now, simply expressed, as it says on the screen, it is the survival of the fittest. The idea is that every plant and many animals produce a lot of offspring, seeds and youngsters, and only a fraction of those survive to maturity in order to produce the next generation. And they're living in a harsh environment, nature red in tooth and claw, as they say. And so it is a situation in which really only the fittest will continue to survive. The weak ones will go to the wall, as it were. And so over a period, natural selection will ensure that the survival of the fittest improves the species. That's the idea. Now, some years ago, I attended a lecture. This was at university, and I was secretary of the Biological Society, and we invited Professor Graham Cannon, who was a fellow of the Royal Society, a very eminent scientist. He was professor of zoology at the University of Manchester, and he gave us a lecture in which he called in question Darwinian evolution, even though he was an evolutionist. And he asked an interesting question. He said, well, if we think of it as the survival of the fittest, how can we identify the fittest? And the answer must be, by definition, those that survive. So he said, well, then Darwinian evolution is the survival of those that survive. It's not a very profound idea, is it? And he was very dismissive. And I'll come back to him a little later, if I may. Well, it actually was almost about to die, was the theory of evolution, because scientists recognized that the variation in species that Darwin thought would give rise to new species actually wasn't adequate to explain the variety of animals and plants on Earth. And his ideas were almost dismissed and ignored after a while. But then scientists discovered a process which would perhaps help them. Darwin assumed that normal variation was adequate to explain this, but in fact that would not be adequate. But the neo-Darwinists discovered mutations. Now, very small variations in animals and perhaps plants, say the different colours of flowers. Some wild plants have different flower colours. These sort of variations, it's still the same species. But just occasionally there's an upset in the genetic mechanism of an organism, and you get quite a relatively large change, at least in relation to the normal variation. And these are called mutations. And it was really the birth of the science of genetics and the study of these mutations that gave Darwin's theory a new lease of life. And a group of scientists call themselves neo-Darwinists, new Darwinism. And from then onwards, of course, the idea grew. So what did they believe? Well, they said random mutations in the genes of all organisms lead to small changes in their form or their function. And, of course, natural selection must favour those with beneficial mutations, and this would increase their chance of survival and reproduction, that is, the survival of the fittest. And over a long period, these changes would accumulate, and eventually, gradually, over many, many thousands or millions of years, the species would evolve. Now, the interesting thing is that mutations are very rarely, if ever, beneficial. In fact, I've still to find anyone who can tell me a mutation that's occurred which was beneficial. Usually, they go the other way. And one remarkable thing about our genetic makeup is that it's quite stable. Indeed, the body has ways of trying to keep it stable, and when a mistake occurs, often that can be repaired, and DNA often repairs itself. And so, although the idea that there may be beneficial mutations occurring and therefore improving a species, the evidence that it does occur is very thin indeed. Well, back in 1859, Darwin published his book On the Origin of Species. And it was a bestseller. Every one of the 1,250 copies that were printed were sold the very first day. Well, of course, everybody wanted to know what this man who'd claimed that we were descended from monkeys had actually said. You know, a bit of pre-publicity. And everybody snapped up a copy. The strange thing is, of course, would be the talk about it, but very few people have actually read the book. Many of them bought it. And I'll tell you why. Because when Professor Cannon was giving his lecture, he disclosed that he'd only ever met one other person who'd read it from cover to cover as he had done. And that was a Japanese scientist who thought, well, as the book's very important, I'll try and read it. And he did. So I decided as a student to be the third person in the world to read the book from cover to cover. But as Professor Cannon predicted, I gave up about page 14. It is the most boring book I have ever read. And as Professor Cannon demonstrated, it's illogical in places. In fact, it would be very good for those who have insomnia. A couple of pages of that every evening and you'll go to sleep in no time. Well, it causes stir in its day, as you'll imagine. And the Bishop of Oxford, William Wilberforce, stood up and opposed this idea at a meeting of the British Association in 1860. He was affectionately known as Soapy Sam. I'm never sure whether it was because he was a slippery character or whether, apparently, when he was preaching, he was doing this with his hands all the time, as though he was washing them. Whichever. But he certainly was quite a character. And, of course, he took the opportunity to ask Thomas Huxley, who was defending Darwin. He asked Thomas Huxley whether it was on his grandfather's or his grandmother's side that he was descended from an ape. Well, you can imagine there was uproar. And records of that meeting are not clear who actually won. Both sides claimed that they'd won. Well, of course, it gave the cartoonist, I'll come to that in a moment. Here's Huxley, just a picture of Huxley. He was known as Darwin's bulldog because he defended Darwin. And, of course, in that debate, he replied by saying he'd rather be descended from an ape than be someone like Wilberforce. You know, you see, it was obviously very, very gentlemanly banter. Anyway, the cartoonist, I said, had a field day. Here is Darwin as an ape man. And there was a cartoon in Punch which started in the middle, the bottom corner with a worm emerging from chaos. And in that sort of cycle, it slowly develops a head and limbs and so on, becomes more monkey-like, and eventually becomes Darwin himself. Well, let's get back to serious things now, shall we? What's the evidence for evolution? Now, we need to be clear at this stage, there's a lot of difference between inference from evidence and proof. Now that might seem a difficult thing to get our minds around, but the point is, facts are facts, but what they mean, we decide by interpretation. We infer from the facts that certain things may be true, but that may not be proof. After all, in a court of law, the jury might decide that the defendant is guilty on the basis of the evidence proved. And then a few years later, there's been a miscarriage of justice because, in fact, what was evidence was not actually really proof. And maybe the person was able to produce clear evidence, indisputable evidence, that he is, in fact, innocent. So what's the evidence? What do they use to try and prove that evolution occurred? Well, there are two main things. One is evolution in action. They tell us that if you look carefully, you can see it happening. And the second, which has been very important until recently, and that is the fossil record. Well, in the student textbooks, which were around when I was a student, it's amazing how much of this has now been dropped. I need to make that point. But it just shows actually how evolutionists believe in sleight of hand. There is a moth, a peppered moth, which normally is black and white, and that's the one that they often use. It's called a peppered moth because it's like white pepper and black pepper. And this moth, Biston betularia, to give it its scientific name, exists in two forms. And moth collectors back in Victorian times were very pleased if they found a black one. Mostly they were black and white, but just occasionally they kept finding the odd one that was completely black. And this was the melanic mutant form of this species. And it was said that before the Industrial Revolution in Britain, the black form was quite rare. It occurred occasionally. But once the amount of soot produced from all the chimneys of the Industrial Revolution increased and air pollution blackened the bark of trees where this moth was used to rest, then it became, of course, much more common. And it suggested, and here's two pictures. The top picture, both of them have two moths on, by the way. The top picture has the black and white form towards the top of the picture, and you can see the black one below it. And here on a clean tree with clean bark, the peppered moth at the top is not easy to pick out, but the black one, of course, below it is quite evident. And so it was argued that while the air was clean, the black moth suffered a disadvantage. The birds could see it, and so it got it eaten. But in the lower part, you'll see we have a soot-blackened tree with the bark that is dark, and the light-coloured normal moth at the top of that lower picture is quite evident, whereas the black form merges in quite nicely. That's the one below it. And so the idea was, this is evolution in action, and that the effects of the Industrial Revolution would mean that the black moth would become more and more prevalent and the white moth would be predated. It was no longer the fittest and therefore wouldn't survive. Well, question is this evolution in action? Well, hardly. Why isn't it? Well, it hasn't changed from one species to another. The melanic form is still the same species. We don't regard people with dark skins from Africa, the negroid form, as a different species from the white Caucasian or the yellow Chinese or the red Indian. And those of us with blue eyes are not a different species from those of us with brown eyes. And those of us who still have some hair and it's dark are not different from those who have light hair. We're all the same species. And so many species occur in different forms. It's still Biston betularia, the peppered moth. The second thing is that when you look at the data that was produced, actually the correlations between the number of black ones and industrial fallout isn't all that convincing. But the third thing that's important is that when experiments were done where moths were pinned onto the trees to see whether the birds could see, you know, each of the various versions according to the background, actually, moths don't hide like that. The moths, in fact, hide under the branch of a tree in the dark. And scientists, looking at this, have now discredited the whole thing. The moth does not behave the way the initial scientists claimed it did. And ironically, even on a clean tree, it's often harder to see the black moth than the normal black and white peppered moth. And that's why this, I put a note there that back in 1986, in fact, to 1987, there was an article in New Scientist by some Cambridge scientists, and they entitled it Exploding the Myth of the Melanic Moth. It's just not true. Now, that's the only example I ever had when I was a student. You know, they're really scraping the barrel, aren't they? Well, maybe there's better evidence in the fossil record, the record in the rocks. Now, of course, what are fossils? Well, they're apparently the remains of plants and animals that lived a long time ago, and they were preserved when they died in the rocks. And so if we look at the various geological periods, we should be able to see evolution occurring. And, of course, the existence of fossils, fossil forms like dinosaurs that are now extinct, or we believe they're extinct, we haven't explored the whole world yet, who knows. And the idea is that the fossils give us evidence that life changed and evolved over long geological periods. And as a result, scientists have produced an evolutionary tree. Now, I need to stress, you won't see all the detail in this slide. But what is interesting is that all the different major groups of organisms, animals that is, go right back to the very beginning. And what is even more interesting is that when you look at this, there's an awful lot of PEC lines. In other words, there aren't actually any fossils at these different geological periods. They've never been found. But if evolution is right, they must be somewhere. And so the line is dotted to indicate that we haven't got the fossils, but they sure must be there somewhere, because evolution must be true. And this is a problem, really, because the fossil evidence doesn't actually support evolution. And even Darwin knew that. He said that in order to establish his theory, it was necessary to find intermediates. In other words, organisms changing from one species to another, or one family, or one phylum or order, all the different classifications of organisms, you'd have to find the in-between ones, the intermediate ones. And none were known in Darwin's day. He couldn't think of a single example. But these missing links, he was sure, would be found as geologists explored the world and more geological science was undertaken. These fossils would actually be found. And he actually admitted that the most obvious and gravest objection to his theory was the absence of any intermediate fossils. Now, some fossil hunters, fossil scientists, their fancy name is paleontologists, actually admit that this is the case. I've got a quotation here from Mark Ridley, Problems of Evolution. He's a very well-recognized evolutionist. I have one of his textbooks, which is very well written, even if I don't believe the results of it. And he says, the fossil record of evolutionary change within single evolutionary lineages is very poor. If evolution is true, species originate through changes of ancestral species. One might expect to be able to see this in the fossil record. In fact, it can be rarely seen. In 1859, Darwin could not cite a single example. And if you think about it, there ought to be more intermediates than anything if they're all changing and evolving, and there isn't one. And others have actually agreed to this. Now, Stephen Jay Gould, again, one of the very famous evolutionists, said the extreme rarity, for that read, total absence, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists today as the trade secret of paleontology. In other words, those who are scientists know it's not true, but nobody's prepared to say it. It's like the emperor's clothes. They know it's not there, but they won't say so. In fact, the same biologist noted that most species are static. They appear in the fossil record and then disappear without any gradual change. He actually uses the phrase that they appear suddenly and fully formed. In other words, it looks very much as though they're created. Niles Eldridge, when we see the introduction of evolutionary novelty, it usually shows up with a big bang, often with no firm evidence that the fossils did not evolve elsewhere. And this, I think, is the most telling phrase in his quotation. Evolution cannot forever be going on somewhere else. See, Darwin thought that he couldn't find it, but once geologists had been around the world and explored all the rocks, they'd find it. But 150 years after Darwin wrote his book, evolutionists are saying, We haven't seen it. It can't be forever going on somewhere else. Yet that is how the fossil record struck many a forlorn paleontologist looking to learn something about evolution. So, in spite of 150 years of research, the missing links are still missing. And I remember my professor saying when I wrote an essay about this, he was very scathing. He was an evolutionist. He said, "Hello, well, if they're missing links, obviously they're missing." And that was it. Well, in order to account for this problem, scientists have come up with an idea. Now, to me, this is a confession of the total failure of evolutionary science. They say what happened in the past was that species were constant for very long periods of time. And then they suddenly evolved into something else very quickly and then were constant, perhaps millions of years, and then evolved again. And the thing is that because they evolved quickly, and the chances of fossils forming is very low, we miss them. Now, that's a theory to explain something that they have as a problem. In other words, there aren't any examples of gradual change and evolutionary process, so they have to think up an explanation as to why they're not there in the rocks. And the idea is that, as I say, they go on steadily and then they suddenly evolve into something else and you missed it, in terms of evolutionary time. So they call this punctuated equilibrium. In other words, it's constant, it's in equilibrium as the species doesn't change, and then just for a point, it changes quickly to something else. Well, it seems to me that this is really an attempt to explain the fact that the fossil record doesn't prove evolution is true. And so, the very fact that they need to propose this tells me that the theory of evolution is bankrupt. We haven't no examples of evolution in action, apparently. We can't see it happening. And if we look in the fossil record where we ought to see it happening, it's not there. And I don't suppose, really, that we can go any further than this. If it did occur like this, then the original ideas of Darwin must be wrong. You can't have it both ways. And of course, rather than admit failure, evolutionists have to keep coming up with ideas to explain away the fact that the evidence isn't there. But what is there, and we can't actually deny this, is that there are lots of living fossils. Many examples have been found of plants and animals originally only known from fossils, and then we find them alive and well. Now, I'm just going to give you two examples, but there are plenty of these. One is the Willimi pine, which was found in Australia just a few years ago. Before that, it was only known in a fossil form. And the other is the coelacanth fish, Latimira columni, which was found in South Africa. And it was only known in fossils before this, although the fishermen there, the native fishermen, have been catching them for years and throwing them back. They weren't good to eat, apparently. So this raises some interesting questions. Now, here's an example. This is the Willimi pine. The rock with the fossils in is there on the right-hand side, and laid on top is a modern leaf. It's exactly like that, and there's a picture of the Willimi pine growing in its native state. And actually, you can buy them now. They're a bit expensive, but I thought it was worth buying one so I can say I've got a living fossil in my garden. And it was only discovered in 1994, and apparently the fossils are 200 million years old. So for 200 million years, the Willimi pine hasn't moved one inch in terms of evolution. And the coelacanth, Latimira, was supposed to be extinct 66 million years ago, and there it is, alive and well, off the coast of South Africa. I wonder how many other living fossils are yet to be found. After all, in real terms, we don't know a great deal about our planet. The depths of the sea have only been mildly investigated. And there are many parts of the world where people have not been and looked for the animals and plants that may be there. So there are many others. There's another problem with fossils. How do you date a fossil? How do you know it was 60 million years old or whatever? Well, fossils are only found in sedimentary rocks. Those igneous rocks, rocks produced by volcanoes and so on, have no fossils because they're obviously very hot when they're formed, and any creature that died on lava would probably be cooked and burnt, and so it's not there. So they're only in things like sandstone and limestone and chalk. Now, it's said that you can date a rock by using radioactive decay methods. But this only works for for igneous rocks. It's very difficult to do it for sedimentary rocks. Because sedimentary rocks, say like a sandstone, are made up of grains of sand. Now, how do you determine whether the sandstone when it was formed was so many billion or million years ago? Or is the age determined from the sand grains that were even older? It's difficult to do this. And actually, when scientists do use these radioactive methods, often you get conflicting results according to which method you use. So, in fact, scientists don't do this. What do they do today? What they actually do is decide the age of the rock. Is it an early rock? Is it a late rock? And then you look at the fossils. Now, how do you date whether it's an early rock or a late rock? Well, you assume the theory of evolution is right, and therefore recent rocks can only contain those animals and plants that we believe evolved later. And so you date the rocks by the fossils, and then when you've got the age of the rock, you can date the fossil. Now, you can see that's a circular argument. And I've had arguments with geologists and said, well, just wait a minute. You haven't changed the sequence of geological succession in the light of radioactive dating. The actual geological epochs were determined long before Darwin. So the Cambrian rocks were first described in Wales, because that's the name of Wales in the past, Cambria. The Jurassic, and we've all heard of Jurassic Park, well, that was named after the rocks in the Jura Mountains in Europe. And the Cretaceous, which means chalk, from the English chalk. And the Carboniferous, meaning carbon-bearing, from the coal measures, originally in England, but elsewhere in the world. And it means, therefore, that, in fact, the ages and the sequence of the rocks was worked out long before geologists started thinking about fossils. And they haven't changed it. Now, we might ask, well, surely, if we got a cliff and we could see the sequence of rocks, the older rocks should surely be at the bottom and the newer rocks should be formed on top of them. Well, maybe that's so, but the strange thing is that geologists, using their normal techniques, in many places in the world, the rocks are in the wrong order. Worse than that, sometimes the layers of old rocks, new rocks, old rocks, new rocks. And all sorts of ingenious ideas have to be put forward to explain this. You know, great masses of rock must have slid over each other, and yet there's no sign of abrasion. It is a problem. Now, nowhere in the world is there a cliff that is actually high enough. If, in fact, we were to put all the geological periods on top of each other, from the Cambrian to the recent, it would have to be 84 miles high, 12 times the height of Mount Everest. And now the Grand Canyon, wonderful though it is, and it's a wonderful place to visit, it's only a mile deep. So nowhere in the world can we see a sequence of rocks that give all the periods in which we might be able to find fossils and work out whether evolution occurred. Now, for me, the most wonderful evidence against evolution is improbability. How likely is it? Now, the science of probabilities and mathematics, of course, is very good. And so you can ask yourself, what are the chances that life would evolve on Earth? How likely is it? Well, people use an analogy. They say, well, if we had enough monkeys and they were typing randomly on a typewriter, each of them, for long enough, we'd have the whole works of Shakespeare. Now, put like that, that seems probable. So somebody tried it. And they got 6 monkeys, and after 1 month and 50 typed pages, there wasn't a single word of English. And I mean by that even a, like the indefinite article, you know, a lecturer, or I, the personal pronoun, because, of course, you need a space either side. Well, some people then said, let's just think about this. Let's bring mathematical probability calculations to play. And the question, how likely is it? Well, if we take a single Shakespeare sonnet, one that, in fact, was used by a mathematician, Gerald Schroeder. He picked a sonnet, I think it was Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day or a Rose, whichever, anyway. It has 400, the classicist in the audience will correct me later, it has 488 letters, so we'll ignore the spaces, they said. And the chances are 1 in 10 to the 690. In other words, the chances are 1 in 1 to 690 zeros after it. Now, there's pretty low odds. If you're a gambling man, and even if you're a physicist, that's zero. The way to think of it, and I think this is even more marvelous, if all the particles in the universe, the protons, the neutrons, and the electrons in every atom, and there are only 10 to the 80 of these, but if every one of those was a computer working, producing 1 million calculations a second, since the estimated beginning of the universe, we still wouldn't have a Shakespeare sonnet by random processes. In fact, the universe would have to be 10 to the 600, that's 10 with 600 noughts after it, bigger than it is. And yet everybody said, well, eventually monkeys could do it. Now, it seems to me we ought to ask the question, how long did it take Shakespeare to write this sonnet? An hour? What an intelligent mind could do in an hour, random processes can't do in eternity. In the whole time of the existence of the universe, with every particle of every atom being a computer, 1 million calculations a second, we still wouldn't have a small sonnet written by Shakespeare. And yet evolutionists say this wonderful world in which we live, with all the complexity of the life upon it, just happened. Now, some of the scientists have actually tried to look at this. It is possible to work out, knowing how rapidly creatures do evolve, if they do, and how favorable mutations might occur, and perhaps advance a species, what would it require? How probable is that we could move from an amoeba, which is a very simple organism, though actually now we know it's very complicated, but for these purposes it's simple, to something complex like a horse. In other words, start with this microscopic blob of jelly, and it mutates over millions and millions of years, and it becomes a horse. Well, that's what they say happened. What's the calculation like? Well, when you do, the odds are very much against evolution. But that hasn't stopped the scientists claiming that it occurred. It's actually mind-blowing as a figure. In fact, I want to quote from a book by Sir Gavin de Beer, who was the former director of the British Museum of Natural History in London, a very famous evolutionist. And in one of the books he wrote, he writes this. Now, I'm sorry the type is small, but I'll read it. Those who invoke mathematical improbability against natural selection can be refuted out of their own mouths. H.G. Muller has estimated that existing knowledge of the percentage of mutations that are beneficial and a reasoned estimate of the number of mutations that would be necessary to convert amoeba into a horse, based on the average magnitude of the effects of mutations, the number required on the basis of chance alone, if there were no natural selection, would be of the order of 1,000 raised to the power of a million. How big is 1,000 raised to the power of a million? Well, it's one with 3 million noughts after it. I worked out that if you were to write 2 zeros every second, you'd be months just writing the number. What does he say? This impossible and meaningless figure serves to illustrate the power of natural selection in collecting favorable mutations and minimizing waste of variation. For horses do exist, and they have evolved. It's the old saying, isn't it? Don't confuse me with facts. My mind is made up. It won't do. It's saying really that, you know, contrary to all the evidence that we've produced so far, they're still saying evolution must have occurred. Now, it seems to me this smacks more of faith than of science. They accuse religious people of having blind faith, but it seems to me it's actually much worse the other way around. Right, well, we have problems trying to get our minds around this number. And so Sir Fred Hoyle, Professor Sir Fred Hoyle, a very famous British astronomer, and Professor Wick Ramasinghe wrote a book, Evolution from Space, and they tried to get over an idea that we could think about the probability of evolution. But by the way, these are not religious men. They were both atheists. And they said the chances that life occurred on Earth are just about as unlikely as a typhoon blowing through a junkyard and constructing a Boeing 747. In other words, you start with one of these, you wait for a typhoon, and lo and behold, you get one of those. Now, if you can believe that, fine. But I have great difficulty. I think if you had a junkyard and a typhoon, you'd just have a spread-out junkyard. But if you're an evolutionist, you get a Boeing 747. Now, there's another problem. And if you like, this is the Hallowell obstacle. I've never seen this in any of the textbooks. But when I was a student, I learned that when an egg is fertilized and it develops, it goes through a very interesting process. You may have seen film of this. It starts with a single egg cell, divides into two, then into four, then into eight, 16, 32, 64, and so on. And when you get a little ball of cells, some of the cells separate and they will form the reproductive organs, the reproductive cells of the adult animal. And from now on, their development will be totally independent. Now, that means that in order to be of any benefit, a mutation, an advantageous mutation, and we don't know of any, but if there ever was one, an advantageous mutation must occur during that short period of development before these cells that will be the reproductive cells separate. Because if it occurs later in the somatic cells, the ones that will form the animal's body, it can't be passed on to the next generation. It may confer some advantage to that particular individual, but it won't be passed on to the next generation. So in evolutionary terms, it's of no value. If it occurs in the reproductive cells, it may well be passed on, but it confers no advantage to the adult, the parent. And so it has to occur in that very small window. And therefore, it seems to me, it's highly improbable. Well, let's just press on. There's a new concept developed actually over in North America, the concept of irreducible complexity. And Professor Michael Behe produced this book, and I think it's a very good book to get if you don't mind struggling with a fair bit of biochemistry. And he called it Darwin's Black Box. And he came to the conclusion that just like the Big Bang, you know, they worked out that the universe is expanding, apparently, and so if you run the film backwards, it must have had a start as a Big Bang. Well, Professor Lee said, well, if evolution has occurred, well, let's run it backwards and see how far we can get in terms of simplification. Well, that was the basic idea. And what he found was that in biochemical systems, you can only go so far and then the system won't work. And he defines it like this. It's a single system of well-matched interacting parts contributing to a basic function where if you remove any one part of the system, then it stops functioning. And of course, what that means is that you can't get parts of organisms any simpler. So they must have evolved at least at that level of complexity. Otherwise, they just wouldn't work. And even Darwin actually recognized that this was an important factor in his ideas. He said if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed from numerous successive slight modifications, then my theory would absolutely break down, and so it does. Now, Dawkins, of course, he's not put off by this. He said, just look at this. It's a quotation from one of his books. Evolution is very possibly, in actual fact, now which? Is very possibly, in actual fact, always gradual. But it must be gradual when it's being used to explain the coming into existence of complicated, apparently designed objects like eyes. For it's not gradual in these cases, it ceases to have any explanatory power at all. We're back to miracle, which is simply a synonym for the total absence of explanation. Now, it seems to me this is a total lack of logic on his part. He assumes that when something's inexplicable, that is, how did complicated structures like eyes appear, gradual evolution must have done it. And yet this is at odds with the scientific idea of punctuated equilibrium that we mentioned earlier. And note two of the phrase, very possibly in actual fact. Now, it either is in actual fact or it's possible. And, you know, it seems to me it's very much like the slogan, there's probably no God. You know, they're not sure. One perfect example of an irreducibly complex object, and sometimes when I give this lecture and I bring one with me, but I thought I might get arrested at customs, so I decided not. It's the mouse trap. An ordinary mouse trap is a wonderful example of an irreducibly complex structure. It has no more than 7 essential parts, including the cheese. And if you have any one of these missing, it doesn't work. It doesn't work very well without cheese. And if you take away the base, or the spring, or the trap, or the trigger, it doesn't work. In other words, if a mouse trap is to evolve, it has to evolve exactly as it is now, complex. Now, much of molecular biochemistry, says Professor Behe, is exactly like that. If you remove any part of it, the whole thing fails. One wonderful example is the bacterial molecular motor. Now, if you did engineering, especially electrical engineering, you can see this is just the way we make electric motors today. But this is on a molecular level. And it's incredibly complicated and amazingly efficient. But if you take any bit of that away, it doesn't work. So when bacteria evolved, it must have come into existence fully made. Otherwise, it's useless. And natural selection surely would distinguish or discriminate against any organism that's making parts that are useless. Now, one of the other things that is very difficult for evolutionists is, how do you account for the large changes? When you look at the animal kingdom, from that little blob of jelly, the amoeba, to something as complicated as a horse, it is a very big jump. How did that occur? One of the fascinating problems that I again met as a student was, how is it that the vertebrates, that's the backboned animals, like ourselves, how did they arise from those without? And this is one of the most pressing problems for evolutionists. You see, backboned animals and more or less all the other animals of the kingdom, in the animal kingdom, are structured differently. Those without backbones have a nervous system at the front, the ventral side, and their circulatory system at the back. Whereas invertebrates, like ourselves, our circulatory system, the heart and the major vessels, is at the front, and our brains and nervous systems are organized at the back. And just to give you a sort of impression, these are two little pictures I made. The invertebrate is at the top, and the vertebrate is at the bottom. And those little things sticking out are meant to be sort of legs or paddles. This is a cross-section of their bodies. So how did it occur? Well, when I was a student, they had no idea, really. They said, well, maybe one of these invertebrates was swimming along, and one day it flipped on its back and said, yeah, I really like this. And from then onwards, you know, backboned animals were formed. I mean, some of the explanations that are given for evolutionary ideas are just mind-blowing. Did you know that not so long ago, the proposal as to why the dinosaurs died out was they died of constipation? Seriously. Because they argued that the plants on which they fed had a purgative action. And when the plants died out, they hadn't got the right food and they died of constipation. And we've moved on from that now. We believe it was a great big meteor that crashed on Earth. But you see, evolution can't be challenged. So you have to find explanations somehow. Well, this was a problem. How do you get from an invertebrate to a vertebrate? Well, apparently our ancestors look like this. They're sea squirts. A sea squirt is called a sea squirt because it lives on the rocks in the sea. And when the tide goes down, it hangs there, a sort of jelly-like mass, a rubbery sort of jelly mass. If you touch one, it contracts and it squirts seawater at you, hence sea squirt. Now, these are sessile creatures. That means they're fixed. But their larvae swim away and eventually develop into an adult sea squirt. And it's said that they look like primitive backboned animals or vertebrates. Here's a picture of one of their so-called tadpoles. So how did it come about? Well, vertebrates, chordates like us, our ancestor was one of these, apparently. And by a process called neoteny, which is just a fancy scientific word for a sort of Peter Pan problem, they never grew up. One of them one day decided it was going to remain as a tadpole for the rest of its life, and it became sexually mature. Man, you need two, I think, but there we are. This is what happened. It became sexually mature and reproduced as a larva and never went back to being a sea squirt. And that's the best we can do. There's no evidence of it, but we have to have an explanation. And so you scratch around until you can find something that may just suffice as an explanation as to where backboned animals came from. Well, is evolution still credible? Well, here Andrew Brown wrote a book and he said, and I think if you take nothing away this evening but that, evolutionary theory is now one of the main myths of our time. And it takes a brave scientist to stand up and say, I don't believe in it. And Michael Bee, the professor I mentioned earlier, he says, the fact that none of these fundamental problems he's raised is even addressed, let alone solved, is a very strong indication that Darwinism is an inadequate framework for understanding the origin of complex biochemical systems. And actually, evolution is not even scientific, in my view. You see, science advances by observing something and saying, well, why is it like that? And then you try and propose an explanation, a hypothesis or a theory. And if your theory is right, you should be able to predict what effect that might have in an experiment. So you make a prediction and then you do an experiment to see if that's right. And if in fact your prediction is wrong, then clearly your theory is wrong and you need to think again. And one of the strange things about science is it doesn't advance by proving things so much as disproving. Let me give you an example of that. Many years ago, scientists believed that when you burnt something and it became heavier, you know, you could take something like magnesium in the laboratory, weigh a piece of magnesium, set fire to it, and it burns with a bright flame. It's often used in fireworks for this brilliant white flame. And then you weigh the ash that's left, and it's heavier than the original magnesium that you had. And in the past, scientists thought there must be a material called phlogiston, meaning from a flame, because they saw the flame going up. And they thought, everything contains something which is actually light, you know, in terms of weight. And when you burn it, it escapes, so the thing becomes heavier. Well, now, of course, we know there's oxygen in the air. It's a chemical reaction. And the reason it weighs more is the magnesium combines with the oxygen in the atmosphere, and so the ash is heavier. But you see, that's how science works. You try things and eventually you discover a better explanation very often. And so you can only really disprove an idea. It's very difficult to prove it. It may fit the facts for a while and then someone does an experiment that shows that your ideas are wrong and you're back to the drawing board. Is evolution scientific? Well, evolution is a theory. You can't test it by experiment. We can't go back into the past and see what was happening and where creatures came from. Nor can we predict the future. If I asked a biologist who was an evolutionist, what's the horse going to turn into in a few million years? No idea. If anything, I don't think it will anyway, but if he's right, what's it going to be? And of course, in science, any evidence which is contrary to your ideas, and in this case, the theory of evolution, if you can find any evidence that is against it, then you have to reject it. And it seems to me that we've got a lot of evidence this evening that evolutionary ideas are untenable, and so creation is really the only alternative. And this is where we began in the beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. And it isn't just in Genesis. It goes through the whole of the Bible. God says here, it's I who made the earth and created mankind upon it. I, my own hands stretch out the heavens. I marshaled their starry hosts. And in the New Testament, the writer to the Hebrews says, by faith we understand the universe was formed at God's command. He said, and it happened. So that what is seen is not made out of what was visible. But most important, the Lord Jesus, the very Son of God, who surely would not know the truth, from his intimate knowledge of his Father, would know whether evolution was right or not. And the Lord Jesus believed in creation. He asked the question, haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female, talking about our origins? Or again, at the beginning of the creation of God, God made them male and female. And even in the middle of an important prophecy about the future of his own people and the impending disasters that would come in what is known as the Olivet Prophecy, he says, pray that the distress will not take place in the winter, because those will be days of distress unequaled from the beginning when God created the world. So the Lord Jesus doesn't believe in evolution. He believes in creation. So we come back to one of our primary questions. Is it creation or evolution? Well, I think there's only one answer. Now, I need to say just something. As a scientist, I have no problem with the early chapters of the book of Genesis. I could spend a whole hour or two now explaining why I have no problem, but we run out of time. Because I take into account other evidence in the Bible. You see, I'm not schizophrenic. I'm not a religious man on Sunday and a scientist from Monday to Saturday. For me, it all fits together perfectly. I take the evidence from the Bible, and I don't think there's any conflict at all between true science and what the Bible teaches. You'd make to bear in mind that Bible prophecy has been fulfilled in remarkable detail. That's difficult to explain away. The evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is incontrovertible. Again, we could spend an hour, and I'm sure I could prove beyond any doubt that Jesus rose from the dead. And the great thing is that the first Christians were willing to die for their faith because they knew it was true. And the rapid growth of the early church is wonderful evidence of the reality of the resurrection of Jesus and the miracles that he performed. So I think in the end we can conclude it's not Christians who are deluded, but those who prefer to avoid the flaws in their theory of evolution. There's probably no God, they said, so stop worrying and enjoy your life. The fool says there's no God. Let's eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. So which is it to be? Belief in a creator who made a world that he's concerned about, who offers through the word of life, the Bible, the opportunity for every man and woman to look forward to a future of perfection and eternal life, not simply saying tomorrow we die and that's the end of it. Or are you going to believe that the universe is just here, there's no purpose in it, and when we die, that's the end of it? Well, the choice is yours.